Hi, this is Dawn Sharina, and this is my podcast, Dancing with Bipolar. Today's guest, Eric Christensen, is an Emmy Award-winning and acclaimed documentarian who has built his brand around socially responsible filmmaking that educates and inspires. As a trauma survivor himself, Eric understands trauma, the resilience of the human spirit, and how important hope is in the healing journey. By spotlighting survivors and their journeys, Christensen has unified audiences around the power of hope and continues to educate the general population about the complexities of trauma. Eric's latest film, Unmasking Hope, is a documentary on the unbridled spirit of human capacity. So, without further ado, let's welcome Eric Christensen to Dancing with Bipolar.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
Good. Hey, it looks like I got everything working, too. Okay, great.
I know. That's amazing when you get the tech to work right the first time around. Let's not jinx it, though, because you never know.
I was excited to – I have a headset I got for these podcasts, and I'm like, oh, can I use my headset? And I plugged into my phone and worked and everything. So we're looking good.
It's a good start to this. So – all right, so I got a couple questions before we start getting into the nitty-gritty of the interview here with you. And what I want to know is, you said that you started making films when you were a very young child. How young were you when you made your first film?
Well, the first film that I made with a script was actually in second grade, I think. So I was about 9 years old or so.
Do you remember what it was about?
It was a safety movie I did for my class. It was like, and it premiered in third grade. So that was the start of the whole thing, I guess.
That's so funny. I mean, it's funny, but it's like awesome. So at that young age, did you have the epiphany that that is exactly what you wanted to do with your life?
You know, that's a really interesting question because, you know, when I was making films so young and putting all these things together and like doing scripts and stuff, I always knew I had a message that I had to carry, you know, to get across, but I never knew exactly what it was. But deep down inside, and it sounds strange, even at like, you know, 9 years old or so, you know, I always knew there was a reason why I was doing this, but I wasn't completely sure what that message was. And now I'm pretty darn sure what the message is I'm supposed to carry. So, yeah.
I think at a young age, you can know what your purpose is, but you just don't know how you're supposed to go about it. And you like can't verbalize it because you don't have the words yet to say, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to affect people in such and such that, you know, at nine, how are you supposed to know that you were going to help, you know, people through trauma? I mean, you probably didn't even know what the word trauma meant at 9 years old.
Oh, I know. And, you know, it's interesting because on a metaphysical level, I think you're fully equipped when you're born. And I think you just develop ways of communicating at it. And at the right time, these things come up. And I think even then I knew, and it was planted in me. I just didn't know what it would take to draw it out of me.
Right. Right. Now, that makes perfect sense after having what happened to you with your major life trauma with the Painted Cave fire, that who would have known that it would have to take something so cataclysmic for you to be able to fully, you know, embrace it and go, oh, my God, this is what I'm actually supposed to be doing to help people.
But isn't that kind of the way it works? You know, I think we're asleep most of the time, and it takes certain things to wake us up to our purpose and to just basically to life and to enjoy life and certain things. It takes these catalysts that come into our life to shock us into action or awareness. And then boom, there you are in so many different levels.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I was just interviewed by somebody on a podcast and he was like, so if all these things hadn't happened to you, all these like grave circumstances that I went through, he goes, would you be the person you are today? And it's like, no, because how you form, you know, it's like coming through these peaks and valleys that form your character. And without all this stuff that I went through, I wouldn't be able to relate to people the way I can now. And I would definitely not be the person I am now.
Yeah. You know? It's a friend of mine always told me, he goes, oh, pain is a touchstone of growth. And I'm like, oh, but how about the growth without pain? You know, but right. No, there's a certain things we have to go through to those touchstones so we can get to the growth.
Yeah, I think there's very little growth without pain. I mean, it's like, you know, grass will grow without wind, but it grows much better when it's stressed. So, you know, I think that's our human nature is just exactly the same as that.
You know, and in my work and in my life, I find myself gravitating towards people that have been through the fire. You know, and even in my personal relationships with my wife, you know, she's been through her own things. And because of that, we have more of a common bond. And so in my personal tribe that I like to hang out with and fellowship with, it's other men that have been through similar experiences and have been through the fire. It's the people that have very few people have been unscathed, I guess, but it's the people that, you know, that have the perfect kind of white picket fence life. It's just, you know, I can't relate.
I can't either. That's what I was saying to this gentleman who interviewed me. It's like, if I wanted to live a life of mediocrity and just be average, then, you know, that's not for me. You know, I kind of need I don't need the trauma anymore. I think I've had enough trauma in my life to last a couple hundred lifetimes, but I like the adventure of life and the spontaneity of it. And just to live like an average vanilla life, I don't think that I could survive that, truthfully.
Oh my gosh, that word mediocrity always leaps out at me. And it's something I use in raising my kids and my family. It's like, you know, it's when we get this feedback that, you know, oh, your kids are doing well, you know, for the, you know, we don't push our kids. We're not those type of parents, but you know what? We don't have necessarily, we don't set our bar according to anybody else, you know?
Right.
So right. It's like, but it's also, but that bar is set by your own passion, especially with raising my kids and stuff, and your own passion and your own drive to create what you want to happen in your life. And hopefully,
already happening. Are you back?
Oh, shit.
Hello.
Oh,
we got you. You were okay. Hello. Yeah, we're back. We were talking about your kids and how you didn't want to raise the bar too high for them.
Oh no. With the kids, it's, you know, it's the mediocrity always comes. The word mediocrity always hits us is, you know, we set the bar high, but we're not those kind of parents that drive the kids. It's their own passion, and we create an environment with our children. We create an environment where they can grow to be as great, and there's no ceiling, but right. There's not, okay. But we create an environment where there's no ceiling, and it's like mediocrity. So going back to the mediocrity thing, you know, we get a lot of feedback from other parents and people. It's like, oh, your kids are doing great for this, da, 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 da. Well, you know, that's great, but it's not what our model is. Our model is it's great according to what they need to do and what their passion and where their path leads us. And it kind of comes back circular into what we were talking at first, knowing what that thing is that you have inside of you. And constantly nurturing it so you can go as far as you can and want with that spark that you have. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. It makes utter sense. I mean, the last thing I want to be known as is status quo. You know, I mean, literally, that's like, you know, who wants to be known as part of the status quo? Not me.
No, and you know, and that's an interesting thing, too, in all my work is... you know, we're constantly progressing and we're at another kind of plateau with my work again in, you know, progressing from, you know, we've done great in public television and everything's been extremely a blessing to us there. But now we're really looking at a bigger market and turning this current film, Unmasking Hope, into a series. and getting it into like the more in the more mainstream and
Wow, like
trying to turn it into
Netflix.
more of a social movement.
Yeah, the I was gonna wait to get to that, but seeing that we brought it up, let's talk a little bit about that. The trailer for it actually made me cry. It affected me like so deeply to see these people that have actually overcome some, and those you only showed what, four of them in the trailer, and I think you have what, seven different subjects
Yeah,
that you.
exactly.
Yeah, and the fellow who I think it was the bar fight, the fellow that has the crosses on his cheeks, that just destroyed me.
He was a police officer. Now he's on physical leave from the police force. Not only is it a physical problem, but he does have severe PTSD too.
Yeah,
From Big Jump when he was on duty.
that scene with
Okay, I'm back. Can you hear me?
yeah, I can hear you just fine. This
Okay,
was
are you able to edit these?
yes, I am able to edit these, so
Okay, then we're set. Okay, so
yeah.
we're talking about Derek Espinoza, the police officer,
Right.
and Derek, after he was jumped and he had to, he basically ended up in the middle of a riot and they couldn't get to him. And so after that, he had to retire from the police force on like a physical disability. And that was really, really tough because his whole family were, police, being a police officer ran in his whole family. His dad was one, his brother was one. And he had a real tough time until he really kind of found his calling, and that's helping other police officers and making other first responders aware of PTSD and also aware of the healing that's behind, doing the work and getting the therapy and things. So he's doing fairly well, but let's see, where were we headed? Oh, okay.
And the
We
masks. Yeah.
were talking about unmasking hope and where unmasking hope is headed, correct?
Right. Yep.
Okay, so I can kind of, do you want to lead me into that?
Well, yeah, I had a couple questions about you
Let's go
with
where you
that.
need to go.
Well, first of all, I wanted to ask you, what are your masks?
It's funny because honestly, I've been in I don't have a lot of options. I've been in recovery now through for 28 years
Yep.
and through an amazing program
Congratulations. Yep.
and a higher power. And the drugs and alcohol is no longer a choice for me, and sometimes I miss being able to totally check out that way.
Right.
So what really are my masks?
Yep.
I use sarcasm and humor. That's a mask I like to cover up a lot with. I'm heavily into kind of denial, I guess. In a way that I don't address certain things, and it's that is one of my points of growth, and that's my mask is, maybe I just don't feel that. I still have a hard time with grieving and moving through things like that. And you'd think after working with all these people and being around this trauma and being, working in films that are about grief recovery, that I would know a little bit about that. But the true fact is that I still have a very difficult time and I need help. And
Huh.
that's what takes a mask off is, I have my mentor I go to. He's an older man and I've had them all through my recovery. And and he helps me take that mask off very quickly and usually with very simple phrases. I have these complex problems, I've hidden all this, and he goes, have you tried taking a look at this? So I still have my mask, and I guess my main one is kind of my sarcasm and the way I look at things, and then denial. I put on the mask of denial.
That's not what I was expecting to hear, but that's really honestly truthful. It's like, wow, thank you for that. And I wanted to know, like, when you're filming these people, seeing that you've been through your own shit, basically, how do you disassociate yourself from them in order to get like the true picture? Because like the way you film stuff is just, it's beautiful, beautifully sad. So how do you do that without like catching yourself up in that?
Well, do we want the kind of short, like, easy answer, or do we want the deeper metaphysical answer?
I want the truth, so go for whatever the truth is.
The honest truth is that it was less than about 4 or 5 years ago. One of my clinical consultants I work with, Dr. Jeremy Crosby, he basically diagnosed me as an empath.
Yep,
And
I could see that. Yep.
it's an ability to connect with people. I can't read people's minds. People are like, "Oh, you read minds." No, I connect deeply with their emotions, and I can read signals, from their body and from their mind, and the way they talk. And so, how do I get those interviews, and how do I not, over connect? That's been a long journey. And once Dr. Crosby had diagnosed me as an empath, he really helped me disconnect from that. When I did my film Searching for Home, Coming Back from War,
Yep.
I would get so involved in the interviews. Essentially, what I tell my crew and how I operate on an interview is that our transparency comes first and connection with the subject comes first and the film comes second. Because we're really there in a almost a healing way to connect with these people, hear their story, let them download, and then we are able to take that sacred story and build a bigger picture with that. But going back to that process is that connection. I can enter into a connection with them, and it usually is after the first two or three questions. And I already have a relationship with them before. I do a lot of pre-interview work.
Right.
And then I literally surf with them emotionally and get connected. So it's all the listening and taking in what they're saying. So that became very detrimental to me when I was working on Searching for Home, Coming Back from War. And I would get back from these shoots and I would literally be. Have basically secondary PTSD.
Right, that makes sense. Yep.
And I would and I'm not I don't want to blow this out of proportion. It's very uncomfortable and everything. And I would still have a strong connection with these people. And it was Dr. Crosby who taught me how to debrief and how I can actually file these things away and these connections and use them in a super positive way for my film. So now when I connect, I'm very honored to enter into that connection with my subjects who become very close friends. And I'm able to take on their sacred stories. And then I just file those away in a very, very special box. And then those become their stories and they don't intermingle with my personal story. There's your emotional being and your emotional state. So they don't become part of my emotional state. They're not who I am, but they can become part of my emotional being that I can open up that box anytime I want and enter back into that connection. Especially when I'm editing and I'm putting the film back out, I can put myself in their shoes again and understand what their perspective is. Then I can interface that with the next participant, and that's how I do the editing. I go through a lot of different viewpoints of the individuals to put together the overall story, and I enter back into back into that stream, but I don't keep that stream open anymore, which I used to, and that was a big mistake until I was again. I owe a lot of thanks to Dr. Crosby for helping me through that.
Yeah, because I can only imagine. I mean, just like, just what the visceral reaction I got just from the trailer for Unmasking Hope. I mean, and it's funny because my next question in here was empath, and I already knew you were an empath. There's no way that you could do what you do without having some kind of empathy towards your people. I mean, there's no way. And so how cathartic is it for you to do these? Does it help you work through? I mean, I know the fire was a long time ago now, and you've probably worked through most of it, but how cathartic is this in your daily life to work with people that have been traumatized and then watch them come through on the other side?
You know, it's interesting because the fire was just a catalyst to this whole thing, and it was trauma for me, but it's kind of minor on the scale of things overall because we have consistent traumas, losing our loved ones, losing my mom, you know, the trauma I did to myself mentally by alcohol and drugs. Yep. And so the catharsis is always great. I mean, just it's such a gift to be able to connect on this level with other individuals and to be able to be handed, it's being handed their story. And so many times it's like, oh, I've never told this to anybody else, or you're like the second or third person I've told this to. To be able to be given that story is, I don't have greater honors in my life other than raising my kids and doing what I do there. But what an amazing honor that is. So how cathartic that is to be able to get to the point where people can hand you and trust you with that sacred story. And then you go out, I'm able to take that responsibility, put it into a film. And not only then is there two levels of healing, the individual in the film gets to see themselves in the film, and it's hugely validating to their life. But not only that, then the second validation comes for all of us when it gets out there and other people go, oh, me too.
Right.
And then they connect with the film like you're connecting just with the trailer.
Yep.
And they go, wow. And that's the second point. I mean, there's so many points of like this gift. And so the catharsis is huge, being able to go from where I was at to be able to give back so much.
Yeah, so it's very humbling to you, isn't it? I mean, it has to be like so humbling.
Oh, completely. And as I say, I'm so honored to be able to be trusted with these stories the way I am and enter into these people's lives on such a deep level.
It's and intimate, yeah.
It's extremely intimate, and yeah. You know, and then to be able to see them grow, you know, sometimes, you know, we instigate a certain amount of healing just by them telling the story, and then when they see themselves in the film, it goes, you know, it's just amazing to see. Then, okay, so yeah, I don't think I'm making that bomb out, am I?
No, I don't know what it is. I mean, it's the Wi-Fi. It's not you specifically. It's just. The whole thing soon, so but for now we're just in the we're doing better than last time. My last interview I had with this was happening, it would cut out, and it was like, but the interview came out great, so
okay, good,
it'll be fine.
No problem. So okay, yeah, real let's point me in the direction we need to go.
Talk about how cathartic it was, but we kind of got to that. But I did want to ask you something about the two, the coming home and homecoming.
Yeah.
I know you said that you have mentors, male mentors. I read that also in an interview I think that you did. Were they the ones that actually led you to do those two films? Was your mentors, or was it already in your mind to do, you know, a movie about or a documentary about war heroes? How did that come about?
You know, you're very intuitive and you pick up on really amazing nuances. I'm super impressed because, you know, it's interesting because my good friend, Bob Trimble, who's the main subject of Homecoming, A Vietnam Vet's Journey, which was done about 16 years ago. he passed away about 5 years ago, but I went through a box of his and I found his diary, and he was one of my mentors. He was a Vietnam vet, Purple Heart, Silver Star, and just recently I came across, literally last week, I came across a box of his, and it had one of his diaries in it, and he was writing about having breakfast tomorrow with Eric and a guy named Fingers. his name's actually Ed Gaughan, but his road name is Fingers. About the film and how Homecoming came about was I was in a meeting with our fellowship meeting with Bob and and a bunch of other guys, and Bob was sharing that he was having a lot of stuff coming up around Vietnam because his mom had just passed away, and he was very confused by all the grief, and Vietnam was coming up again, and he had heard about this motorcycle run from California, the wall in Washington, D.C., and he was thinking of going on this run. And it was several years after I just finished my film Faces in the Fire, which is about the recovery after a natural disaster and about my personal recovery. And I was praying for another film very similar to that. And all of a sudden he says that he's going on this motorcycle run. So I said, "Hey, Bob, you know, I'm very interested in going." And that's how this whole thing started. And then literally, while I filmed that and went across the United States with 300 Vietnam vets on motorcycles, I was in a four-wheeler. But literally on the shoot of that, I was basically initiated into the brotherhood of these amazing veterans. And through all the stuff I've went through in my personal recovery and to me, I was able to really connect with the veterans, and that's how I got into that whole space. And, you know, it wasn't like, oh man, there's a lot of drama here, this is going to be a good story. It wasn't that. It was that I was led into that space, and I have a blessing of this understanding of these veterans. I mean, one of the biggest compliments I get at a film festival is when a veteran comes up to me and goes, "Are you a vet?" And I go, "Oh no, I'm not." He goes, "Then how do you understand this?" You know? And, but yeah, it was Bob Trimble that started this whole thing. And it's become, a theme of mine is doing this grief recovery and doing films based on the truth, which is what happened, the point of trauma, sometimes several points of trauma, the hope. I'm sorry, it's the truth. You can cut this part out. I got it backwards again. Okay. But I do films based on, you know, these three pillars, which is the truth is what happened, the point of trauma. Sometimes there's several points of trauma, the healing, and sometimes between the point of trauma and the healing, it can be years. Right. But the healing is when you finally hear somebody else share or see something else and go, "Oh my gosh, me too." Right. And you have this identification, and that's the start of the healing. And then the hope, as defined in our three pillars, is when you get into a certain extent in your healing, you go back and you start to help others that are still in the truth, and that's the hope. And so Bob introduced me to this whole world that's become what I'm doing now. So yeah, it was one of my mentors that really brought me into this whole thing, and that's over, I don't know how many years ago.
A while ago, but yeah, I mean, it's funny because somebody just asked me if I had a mentor. And I was like, do I need one? You know, and it's like, maybe I do need a mentor. I don't know. What did the mentorship actually like fill you?
You know, I have my rules of mentorship, you know, and it, for me, you know, I have to, number one, they're little tiny rules, and then this is what comes out of it. But it's like, number one, to get a mentor, it's up to you. And it's up to you then to make the time and the dates and then take care of that and then meet with them and show up. Then once you actually show up, you have to listen to them.
Right.
And not only listen to them, but then you have to actually take action on some of the things they say. You know, make it a formal relationship. I want you to be my mentor. And then you make it a formal relationship. And then so you have to listen to them and let them speak into you, you know, and not be offended, and then take action, their recommended action on the things that they're talking about. Then one of the biggest rules is letting them be wrong occasionally.
Oh.
You know, and then but what comes out of that, and I think especially for my basic demographic, you know, for a man that's, you know, gosh, I hate to say this, in his mid-50s, and you know, I'm married with my family and everything. And what I get out of that is I get guidance. I'm not self-propelled, you know. And God speaks through my mentor to speak to me. And I need to hear that. And I need to hear somebody that's already walked along that path and has already made the mistakes. And I need to have somebody I can be 100% honest with. And by being 100% honest, and I have a okay, so I know exactly where I was at with that. Cool. So I'll pick up. Okay. Yeah. So then with what's awesome about having a mentor is, and you have one person, and particularly somebody that's walked that path before, and he, you know, and it's, so for me, a certain amount of spirituality comes into play, but it's real important that I have one point person that is I'm 100% transparent with. They know what's going on with me. And again, as I said, I allow them to speak into me. I'll take those actions, but also I'll allow them to be wrong. But for me, then I'm not self-propelled. I'm not like just operating out of my own selfish concerns constantly. I have somebody else that is like, I'm able to bounce things off of, that able to write me and kind of set me on certain paths. And I can honestly say that I feel very strongly, if most men were to allow themselves to have this kind of relationship, that there'd be a lot less divorces. There'd be a lot more connected dads.
Yep.
And I think it would solve a lot of basic problems, because honestly, I think men are just, this is terrible. A lot of men just act out like 12-year-old boys, and it's just out of the selfish concern, and we have a tendency to get lost. So I need somebody to kind of guide me along.
I think it could have something to do with selfishness, but also just not knowing what to do. Like, you don't know what you don't know. So if nobody's taught you how to be a man or a woman, then you're just kind of, you know, you're just like free-willing it all on your own, and you have no clue what you're up to. So, you know, I like the idea of having a mentor, but it was just kind of funny when this person brought it up to me, and I was like, no, I tried to have a mentor last year and it just kind of fell through the cracks. And like, do you think I need a mentor? You know, like, because I didn't know where he was going with the question.
it's a huge commitment on both sides, you know. Yeah. And finding the right people is a huge component. But also, you know, as I say, one of my first rules is that the mentee takes that obligation and the responsibility to set up the times, to take care of that relationship, to make sure it happens, because that shouldn't be on the mentor. The mentor is there to give more than that. And I'm able to be mentor guys now too. And so it's pretty cool, because now we have like a whole little downline of men that are in this downline, basically, of men that take time to spend with each other and connect and, you know, and speak into each other's lives.
Yeah, it's amazing, because I'm actually, now that I've been doing the podcast for a minute, and I'm like, everybody is urging me to write a book now, because like, they've gotten a taste of my life, although they don't really know the whole, I haven't like spilled the whole beans yet on my life yet on the podcast, but they're urging me to write a book. And I'm thinking that if I do go ahead and do that, that a mentor would probably be a really good idea to keep me on track and like not lose my shit halfway through the writing of the book.
Oh my gosh. And that's a big point that I didn't even talk about, is the accountability and having somebody just to be accountable to.
Yep.
Say, you know, I'm going to get this many pages done, and I'm going to do this, and I need to check in with you, because it's tough territory. And, you know, what an awesome thing to have somebody available for that.
Yeah. So I guess I'm going to go back to my first lady, who actually, like, she's a journalist, and she's a pretty amazing woman, had a pretty up and down life, has had her traumas too. And I think she could keep me online, but also like those moments where it's like, I just can't continue to write about this one subject, could urge me to keep on going, because it's vitally important to the whole story. But some stuff is, as you well know, some stuff is really hard to talk about. Like, just don't want to share it. I don't want to bring it back up. I'm going to need to if I do write this book. So,
you know, it's interesting with those certain subjects, you know, and those certain places that are just so hard to get to, that once you start and once you sit down and once you start moving on something like this, this is just personally my personal experience. And those certain islands and those certain places that you have so guarded, but once you sit down and start and you're like, oh, this seems so freaking lame. And I'm and you're just like writing, just like, this is boring, everybody. And then all of a sudden, by just the process of like doing this, things start to roll and it starts a process of going through those places. And if I can recommend this book that changed my life, it's called The War of Art.
I saw that in one of your articles. Yeah, you mentioned that. The War of Art.
Oh, my God. The War of Art. And I can't remember the guy's name. Oh, gosh. I
find it.
But The War of Art. And he talks about just sitting down and getting this thing done. And then he talks about resistance, you know, and all how resistance shows up from all these different sides when something is so important to our souls to get done or to get out there or to accomplish, that then we start encountering all these different areas of resistance, procrastination, you know, self-generated resistance, and then outside resistance that we start to interpret as a resistance and something keeping us from getting to our goals. And it just identifies all this. So then we become aware so we can work through it. And I'm right in the middle of all that. All the time.
Say, right? You live that. I mean, before the tech eats us up again, when you come closer to unveiling Unmasking Hope, I'd love to have you back on again to talk about the further journey of actually the editing and finishing up the film. Is there anything you want to leave the audience with, Hope, or anything that you want to leave my audience with?
Oh my gosh, that's huge. Is, you know, speaking of resistance. And you know, what's actually personal to me right now that I'm working through is self-doubt, you know, and at 56 years old, here I am again, pushing another project, trying to get it done. You know, it's not economically, it's not paying off necessarily yet, or it might not, you know. But the question is pushing through that self-doubt when you have something you need to do so that is so important to your soul and so important to others that, you know, when you wake up, that you take care of yourself in the proper way, get the meditation, read the right, whatever your meditations are, or read the right affirmations and things. And what I'm saying is just pushing through self-doubt so we can fully realize what our goal is. Because, man, my self-doubt thing, you should get a real job. You should go do this. Look at this and look at that. And what about this? And it's just like, you got to stop that self-doubt voice and move ahead with what's in front of you that basically for me, God has given you as your path to not only fulfill your soul, but to help others. And so getting through that self-doubt's a big deal for me all the time.
So how do you, my audience is full of people with mental health issues and people that are in love with people with mental health issues and how, you know, we interconnect on that level. So what would be your main message to my audience to get to that level of pushing through the self-doubt?
You know, it goes back to what my mentor says. You actually just have to sit down and do it. You know, you just have to sit down and take the action. You know, and it just, and what does that action look like? I'm not sure. You know, a lot of people go to, you know, I'm a very spiritual man and I go to prayer, but you know, a lot of people go to prayer way too early. It's like, you got to figure out what the actions I can take today that are going to move me forward. And is it writing that letter? Is it sitting down? I'm going to just name my book and do some chapters to it. Is it just for me? And for other people like me, is it just getting to a meeting of other people like me, my fellowship, where I... Okay, so I can pick that up. Do you want me to go ahead and pick that up?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. So basically, for me, that self-doubt is just taking the action. And I sometimes have to write down a list of what the actions are. So I just know what to do. I got to get to a meeting. I got to get out there. I got to like connect with my people. So then I know I'm not alone. I got to connect with somebody else that is very similar to me. You know, I'm an addict. I'm an alcoholic. I have to connect with other people like that, you know? And then once I do that, I'm like, okay, I'm not alone. I'm not this crazy person out there floating, you know? And then I can go make this small list. And what's the small list? Is it just sitting down in front of my computer today to like outline my book? Is it just actually, for some of us, is it actually just making sure I can like organize my meds and I get like, wow. I'm going to go to Walmart today and I'm going to buy one of those old people med things. So yeah. I'm not like my meds, you know? And that's like, that's moving forwards, you know? So little victories and little commitments build up to big things. And it's just like doing those little things. And then by doing those little things, then I'll end with this. A great guy told me, and he old timer, as we call him, you know, I was complaining about something, saying about something. He says, do you make your bed every morning? I'm like, what does that have to do with anything? He goes, do you make your bed every morning? I'm like, no. I'm like, you're pretty crazy. What? He goes, you should just start doing that. And I can tell you now, after I've been doing that for the last 5 years, make my bed every morning. I make it for my wife and I make my bed every morning. And you know what it does? It gives me the first thing in the morning, I get a sense of accomplishment that I've actually done one thing. And then I move on from there. And it's make your bed every morning. It's so simple, but man, it's almost life changing.
And you know what? I don't make my bed every morning. So now I'm going to start doing that and see how it affects my life in a good way. Because that's easily done, right? And I don't do it.
It's so simple. And that's a gift from like mentorship of like these old timers going, just make your bed every morning. It's like, hey, that's way too simple. I have these big problems. Don't you understand? Right.
All right. Well, that's brilliant. And before the tech gets us again, I do plan on having you back getting closer to the release of Unmasking Hope. Keep in touch with me. You know, this has been an amazing interview, even with the glitches. We'll get through that.
And you know what? I would love to chat with you a little bit more. Feel free to text me anytime. I want to hear about your story. Now I'm fascinated. So let's stay connected. You're extremely intuitive. I love the questions. Thank you.
Cool. You're welcome. And this has been a great interview. I'm going to put it up as soon as I get some of the stuff edited out, and I'll send you a copy of it.
Sounds great. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Eric. Thank you, actually. And best of luck on this project. I know it's going to be a bomb when it comes out. I know you're going to kill it when it comes out.
Here's the funny thing, just real quickly, is, you know, through doing this film, Unmasking Hope, now it's turned into a series. And so we're trying to sell it as a series. Then the same producer, who is now in the Producers Guild, and she's very connected, it's like, do you have anything else? You mentioned you wanted to do a feature sometime. I'm like, well, I'm thinking about doing a feature about, you know, my film Homecoming, a Vietnam Vet's Journey, about a vet looking back on his life on his last motorcycle run. And she goes, oh my gosh, can you write that up for me? So here I am now. I'm writing a whole freaking script, and I meet with an investor in about 2 weeks. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, go fantastic.
talk about the self-doubt monster. You know, every morning it's like, Eric, are you really writing a script? Come on.
Well, I can personally tell you it's going to go well. Everything in your future is going to go very well. You're a real person. You're true and you're honest. And that's really all it takes in this world to sell yourself. So I think you're doing a 100% job right there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And do stay in contact. I want to learn more about you, and we'll form our own little support system.
I love that. Sounds great. All right. Okay, so you have a great rest of your day. Go have some lunch. And
I will.
All right. Thank you, Eric.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Wow, huh? What an interview. I really want to thank Eric Christensen again for coming on and telling us about his journey into finding hope out of trauma and how it has totally changed his life and his perspective on now wanting to do films that show how people journey through their own trauma. This is one of my favorite interviews to date. I really, really enjoyed speaking with Eric. So this is Dawn Shireen. This is my podcast, Dancing with Bipolar. Y'all stay alive now, okay? Later.